Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future, live or on demand. I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the contested Tshwane cleaning levy is crushed as a court rules it unlawful. South Africa slammed by a 30% tariff, and now there is new alarm over African business expansion. The repo rate cut brings some breathing room, but many in South Africa are still gasping. And Capitec makes customer calls free and frictionless. It's Friday, the 1st of August. Now, with South Africa's growth forecast stuck at just 1%, more and more local companies are casting their gaze northwards towards Africa's many untapped markets. And for many today, this could be seen as a potential imperative as the 30% Trump tariff hike is now implemented. But for every success story, there are cautionary tales of rushed expansion, misunderstood regulations, and also cultural blind spots. I'm in conversation now with Sebastian De Plas, who is a partner at Forvis Mazars, and he says the opportunities are real, but there are risks. And as global giants scale back in Africa, a new wave of regionally focused players is stepping in. So let's talk to him about what business gets wrong, what they need to get right, and why a one-size-fits-all strategy is often a recipe for failure. So, Sebastian, a very warm welcome. Let's start with a reality check. In your opinion, what's the biggest myth that South African companies have about expanding in Africa? I would imagine they go in with their eyes wide open and often they get a bloody nose.
Yeah, hi, Jeremy. Thank you. So interesting, globally in the world, 83% of the companies are thinking about growing in new markets internationally in the next 5 years. And it represents 66% of the companies in Africa. So as you said, there are certainly big opportunities on the continent for South Africa companies to grow. There is a young population, a population that is growing very fast and will be as the first population in the world. So obviously it goes with markets that are growing, like financial services, infrastructure, telecom, consumer goods, and actually most of the market. So there are opportunities, we all know it, but there are as well big challenges. And I would say that the first one is to make the mistake or the misunderstanding that Africa is the same. So Africa is one continent, it's a geographical limitation of countries, but the reality is that between countries in North Africa, Southern Africa, or West Africa, the culture is very different. And in terms of strategy, you cannot apply what has worked in South Africa in West or North Africa, because the way consumer buying, the way people are paying is very different. And I would say this is one of the major challenge in terms of strategy that have the South African companies, is sometimes to go to some countries with their own eye and their own view on what they have done and worked in South Africa.
So often businesses view Africa then as a homogenous market. You're suggesting to me that that is very dangerous and often foolish thinking, I would imagine. How do they need to recalibrate or change their thinking, adopt a different strategy in that regard? What would they need to do, given that your C-suite barometer highlights this huge potential that exists right now?
Yeah, I think so. To match the strategy of expansion, they need to have an operational view. So it's very important to understand when we go in a country, the local regulation and different topics such as the employees we'll work with, their culture, how people are interacting, and how do we work together. In terms of operation, as I said, one of the challenges that have these companies is that when you expand in a country, the market in a smaller country in Africa may not be as large or to start at least than in South Africa. You may locally have teams that are not as big as what you have in South Africa. And also, as you probably know, but it's not always easy to travel from South Africa to a lot of countries, especially in West Africa. So sometimes it can feel that our team that are in some countries are far from the head office that is based in South Africa. So they are what we have seen with our client and as well in that barometer that we have done with the C-suite from South African companies is that there are ways to work in that context. I give you a few examples. We have worked recently with companies that are very large companies that are asking us in Africa to look at taking over all, for example, their accounting or their IT or their HR department, where they want to, instead of having teams locally and take some risk to have teams that, as again, I said, are far from them and that they cannot control, and more risk of corruption, more risk of process that are not the same in a small team in a far country. They decide to subcontract it to different firms and, for example, to an audit and accounting firm to subcontract this accounting. And interesting, what we have seen recently is subcontracting your accounting was in the past mainly for SMEs because it was easier for them to have an external firm do their accounting. But what we see today is even very large international companies are looking at that option to cover the risk of, for example, corruption, of having a certain quality reporting on time. So this is one of the example on how these companies could cover themselves when they open a subsidiary in a new country that they don't know yet, and also
Right.
finding the right partner.
Sebastian, overnight, I would suggest to you that the paradigm or the landscape has really changed given the 30% tariffs on South African goods that have been implemented by the United States. As a result of that, do you think there's going to be more of a rush now into Africa by South African companies looking to expand and expand urgently?
Yeah, there will be certainly a rush, a short-term rush, but I'm always very cautious because, yes, we are talking about the 30%, but it may be some regulations that will change. As we know, things are changing very quickly from the US at the moment, and we don't know what it will be next year. And what I think is Africa development has to be a long-term strategy. So we have to be careful not to rush quickly now to wait for quick results, but really to spend time to find the right partners and to have the time to develop and to have long-term strategies. So yes, there will be a rush, but it has to be a rush with a long-term thinking for the South African companies that want to explore African markets.
Sebastian de Plas, thank you very much indeed. Partner at the Forvis Mazars Company, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let's move now from tariffs to technology. And in a country where digital access and affordability remain barriers for millions of people, even a simple phone call to your bank can be out of reach. But what if the technology could remove that barrier entirely and also build trust at the same time? Well, Capitec has quietly introduced a breakthrough feature. It's called Zero Airtime in-app calling that allows clients to reach support without using data or airtime. It's not just a technical upgrade. I think it's a rethink of what banking support should be. should really mean in a digital society. In that respect, Andrew Baker is with me, Capitec's Chief Technology Officer. Andrew, a very warm welcome. And you frame this initiative as solving a real-world problem. I understand that. But were there trade-offs that you had to encounter between cost, complexity, and principle when introducing zero-time or zero-airtime calling?
Morning. Thanks very much for inviting me on the show. To answer your question quickly, there's always trade-offs when you change something. And I think what you would see in with most of the other banks is the arrangement is to split the call fee. 50% is paid by the bank and 50% is paid by the client. But the challenge you get with that is that banks are no longer just doing savings and check accounts. They also sell you airtime and data. So what happens if that airtime and data transaction fails? How do you phone them to get help with that when you need airtime to phone us? So we made a call early on in the project that if we were going to do something, it had to be profound and it had to be a shift. And so we made the call, irrespective of the commercials, that we were going to do this project and it was going to be free for everyone.
And in that respect, then, I'd suggest to you that access and dignity aren't always metrics that appear on a balance sheet, but central, as I pointed out, to this feature. How do you quantify the return on investment of trust and inclusion in this whole concept?
Yeah, that's a really good comment. So there's no business case for this. We didn't sit there and go, if we did this, we're going to get X money back in return. One of the questions that get asked internally is, are we delighting our clients? Are our clients happy? And I think if you can find, and there's always flaws, doesn't matter who you work for, you always have imperfection, you have issues. And so if you can't speak to your client, if your client can't get hold of you, if they're in rural South Africa and they have to travel 100 kilometers to get to a branch to have contact with somebody, then there's a fundamental failing. And so I think sometimes you have to go past balance sheets and you have to go past income, and you can just get to the point where you say, actually, we can do this. We're big enough to do this and our clients will like it. And it's the right thing to do. So the business case for it actually was really, really simple. If something goes wrong, we want our clients to be able to speak to us. And right now, that's not always the case.
I understand that this began as a security initiative, and I understand that. But it also says something, does it not, about how banks can or even should start to turn compliance and risk management into vehicles for innovation that focuses on the customer?
Yeah, absolutely. So most people have heard of phishing and vishing and smishing and all the other ishings that there are. And so what happens is someone contacts you and they pretend to be the bank. And so internally, we originally thought it was an education problem. Let's tell everyone that, you know, we will never ask you for these details over the phone. But the reality is my mum is 80 years old and she's an intelligent woman, and I think she would fall for this. I've heard the calls. I've heard the recordings of the scams that happen. And the reality is under duress, most people will forget what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do. So we decided that we would make it transparent to our clients when you log into the app, that we will tell you if you're on a phone call, we will say that you are not talking to Capitec. Or you are talking to Capitec. We won't just say you're on a call, bad things can happen. We will literally tell you who you're speaking to in Capitec, or we will say that whoever you're speaking to, it is not someone from Capitec. And that had a massive impact on our fraud. So what you're absolutely right, it started off as a fraud initiative to say, let's be really transparent with people. If we phone you, it's very easy with our technology to know that we're calling you. Let's make that visible to you.
I fully expect you, Andrew, to answer this next question by saying it's not my problem, ask the other banks, but I'm going to put it to you anyway. This model of frictionless, cost-free support, it could become a new benchmark in financial inclusion. I suppose we've got to ask what's holding other institutions back.
I like the way you look at that, actually, because I think being first feels great and you go, yeah, awesome. But actually, it I think everyone else will follow. I hope they follow. There's no reason for them not to follow. And if I'm being really transparent, we are actually saving money by doing this initiative. That wasn't the intention of it. We have a better client experience, and it's costing us less money than the old solution. And we can serve our clients about 30% faster. So if the other banks are listening, I think it would be awesome if they followed suit.
But there is a hard daily cost, surely, for the bank itself. I mean, you are absorbing that cost of the caller, you're not.
It's cheaper. So we paid about 60 in the old world, it'd be about 60 cents per minute. 30 cents went to the client, 30 cents went to us. In the new world, roughly speaking, it's about 10 cents a minute. So we absorb the full 10 cents, right? We take the whole cost. But actually, we're getting 20 cents cheaper call, and the client's getting 100% cheaper call.
Just a final one. Obviously, there's a cost imperative, as you've just outlined to me. I guess it's going to boost efficiency as well. But there are
Yes.
cultural and I guess even reputational stakes if you get this wrong, particularly in a high frustration moment for clients. And often they are making that call because they're very frustrated.
That's right. Yes, and so I don't think we're done here, actually. So what always happens on a call is like there's two parts to the call. Who are you? And validating who you are. That's gone now because we know who you are. You're logged into our channel. The next part of the call is what you're trying to do. And so what we will shift to shortly is contextual calling, so that we will know what you're trying to do, what screen you're on, what error you're seeing, and we can immediately assist you. So we're trying to cut the whole thing down to a feeling of we've got this, and we know how to help you.
Just quickly then, as far as contextual calling is concerned, is there an ethical line between helpful personalization and, how do I put this, maybe perceived surveillance?
Yes, I understand what you're saying. It might feel creepy that you click a button and I know exactly what you're on. What happens in contextual calling is when you click that button, we would say, "Do you want help with this transaction?" So we're intentionally telling the client that you're going to talk to us about this thing. So the ex and so all we do is we pass that information on the call line, and it loads up in the call center. As the call opens with us, we can see all of that information on the screen. So we try to avoid the feeling of those eerie calls, like the Google moments where you're looking for a camera and suddenly it knows that. It's not quite like that, but I understand your point.
Andrew Baker, thank you very much indeed. Chief Technology Officer at Capitec.
Mind-blowing, innovative, and internationally acclaimed, Le Petit Chef is a gastronomic experience like no other. A unique, never-to-be-forgotten 3D and 4K tabletop projected dinner filled with fun, surprise, and storytelling. Fancy a journey across the globe without ever leaving your seat. You could win two tickets worth nearly 4,000 rand to experience the world's tiniest chef with the biggest culinary adventure. Enjoy six unforgettable courses inspired by Marco Polo's travels, from the fragrant spices of India to the icy peaks of the Himalayas, all paired with fine wine in a luxury setting at Blueberry Hill Hotel. Enter now at events@moneyweb.co.za and tell us about the official hashtag for the event. Your taste buds are ready for takeoff. #DinnertimeStoriesSA.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
So, South African consumers getting a rare bit of good news this week. The Reserve Bank cutting the repo rate by 25 basis points, bringing it down to 7%. And along with that coming a shift in monetary policy strategy, a new, more ambitious inflation anchor of 3%. And that's aimed at lowering borrowing costs in the long run. But in reality, though, what does this mean for your pocket and my pocket right now? And how can we make the smaller rate cut work a little bit harder? In that respect, I'm in conversation now with Makgauta Mpahlele, who's Executive Director of the South African Credit and Risk Reporting Association and former Consumer Protection Ombudsman. And a very warm welcome and thanks for joining us. So, a little bit of good news, but what does this rate cut actually mean for the average highly indebted South African household? Does it make any difference at all, do you think?
Yes, Jeremy, it does make a difference because in terms of the National Credit Act, the interest rate that we are charged for all credit agreements is linked to the repo rate. So depending on the type of credit agreement, you would have the repo rate plus a percentage. So it does definitely reduce the cost of borrowing and the interest that is charged.
But is it going to make a real dent in someone's monthly financial life or just give a little bit of assistance?
A little bit, because, you know, we can't look at this relief in isolation, because as consumers, we are facing other pressures where the cost is rising, you know, above the inflation, especially in relation to administered prices. Your electricity, your water, your rates and taxes are increasing above inflation, but you have, and also you have other pressures. So it's a little bit of relief.
So what kind of credit then, either credit cards or car loans or mortgages, should consumers be targeting first if they want to take advantage of this cut?
As I said, each credit agreement has its own interest rate. For example, your highest ones would be your personal loans, because it's the repo rate plus 21%, which means with the current repo rate at 71%, you are paying 28% interest rate for personal loans. And then for credit cards, it's plus 14%. So, you know, when it comes to cars and houses, there is a bit of competition because they don't charge the maximum that is allowed in terms of the act. They usually charge prime. Prime is currently 10.5%. So at least there, you know, if your credit score is good, your profile is good, you can negotiate. But personal loans, they usually charge maximum.
So maybe this is also a window to, in a small way, to either restructure or consolidate debt. I think that's what I'm hearing you say.
Yes. I mean, if you can afford to, I always advise people not to change the monthly installment that you are paying, because remember, with the repo rate going down, the banks and other credit providers would automatically reduce your installment. So if you can afford to go back to them and say, don't change the installment, continue to pay what you are paying, because that will help you reduce your debt.
The Reserve Bank also, I think, surprising the market overnight by setting a new inflation anchor of 3%. It would be some good news for consumers, I imagine, or do you think it comes with hidden risks?
You know, Jeremy, like I said, remember the inflation is average. So, but if you look at the real cost of other increases that the consumer has to absorb, and the fact that our wages and salaries are lagging behind, and administered prices are a real problem, because if you look at by how far your rates and taxes have increased, electricity and so on, if they, and I saw in their press release that they said they need to look at that and manage those. If they manage that, I think then there will be a real difference for consumers. But for now, I don't think so.
So many South Africans then remain financially stretched in spite of the small cut. For people who feel that they don't benefit from the announcement, is there any advice that you've got as to how they can protect their credit health to the best of their ability?
I think the most important thing is that when we borrow, usually we don't think about future interest rate fluctuations. So some people borrow to the maximum of their affordability, because you're sitting with a consultant who will say, Makauta, you qualify for 50,000. But don't take that, because you need to consider that if you're buying a car, there's maintenance costs. If you're buying a house, there's other hidden costs. And then you have these interest rate fluctuations. So first, don't borrow to the maximum of your affordability. And of course, we need to look at our lifestyles and make sure that we really manage our spending and spend on essential things. And if we are in trouble, we cannot manage, we need to speak to our creditors.
Often for many South Africans, though, they can't even afford the essentials, can they?
Yes, unfortunately, that is the case.
So in that respect, then, your association has just launched something called the Data Submission Monitor, I understand. What does your current data tell you about the current state of consumer debt in this country?
Jeremy, I think we need to understand that SACRA doesn't hold consumer payment profile. We facilitate the submission of the data to the credit bureaus. So what we are able to see is really around compliance levels, because all credit providers and some data providers are required to submit this data through SACRA to the credit bureau, so that when they make credit and risk decision, they can see the exposure of the consumer and they can also see affordability. But in terms of the products that are being submitted, we are seeing a growth in personal loans and credit cards and retail. And that's where most of the borrowing is happening.
Thank you very much indeed for that update. That's Makgautam Pahlele, who's Executive Director of the South African Credit and Risk Reporting Association. She's also former Consumer Protection Ombudsman. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And let's finish the program with city politics, and it's been labelled illegal, irrational, and now it's officially gone. The Gauteng High Court has ruled the City of Tshwane's controversial 50 Rand city cleansing levy's got to be scrapped, declaring it unlawful and setting aside its implementation. It follows months of backlash and legal challenges from residents and business groups who accuse the Metro of bypassing due process to plug a financial hole. The Democratic Alliance says it welcomes the court ruling, but that also raises questions about how the levy came to be introduced in the first place, and also, perhaps more importantly, what it means for the city's fragile finances. I'm joined now by Councillor Jackie Ace, DA Tshwane spokesperson for finance. Councillor, welcome. The court finding that public participation was inadequate and that the levy was irrational. I mean, that's a fundamental failure of governance, isn't it?
Yes, what this court ruling is showing is what the DA pointed out, that the residents do not want a new tax. Residents cannot afford a new tax. And the government of the day just went ahead, steamrolled this new tax into existence. And the prime purpose of it was that having a funded budget was more important for them than, number one, delivering services, and number two, considering the residents that they are supposed to serve. In the city of Tshwane, having your bin lifted costs you about 500 rand a month if you choose to use the city. Residents, of course, can't afford that. And now what the municipality decided to do was to penalize them with a fee of almost 200 rand a month should they choose not to use the city's services. We can't find ourselves in a place where the municipality penalizes you if you choose not to use their services because it's either too expensive or because it is not of a good quality. Mm. And the court agreed with us here, and we are thankful to AfriForum who brought this case to court.
Now, Councillor, you'll correct me if my timelines are wrong here, but you've welcomed the ruling, but wasn't the levy introduced by your own administration in the first place, which suggests that something unlawful passed under your watch?
Now, the levy was introduced on the 1st of July this year, and it was brought by a budget that was brought by the current ANC government. Previously, in last year, the administration did ask the DA to bring this levy, and the MAKO of the time rejected it and said that we will not bring a budget that includes this levy. What we should distinguish is a charge that is brought on city residents who uses the city for waste removal, and a charge that is that is charged on residents that does not use the city for waste removal, as we are seeing in this case. So the city cleansing levy that is billed on accounts who use the city for waste removal is a charge that is used to maintain the dump sites. However, when you do not use the city for waste removal, your company that lifts your waste for you pay per load that they dump at the dump sites. So in essence, this city cleansing levy brought by the ANC government was going to double charge residents who use private collectors.
Now, the city was hoping to raise a considerable amount of money from this levy. Now that's off the table. Where exactly is that money going to come from then? And again, in what way are residents going to be affected by the way in which the city is kept clean?
So it is very concerning, number one, that the city chose to rather raise taxes than cut costs. Cutting off costs would be would have been the first option that the DA would have taken. And the biggest low-hanging fruit in this is to curb electricity and water losses. Now, the government currently have a unfunded budget, and they do not have a funding plan, which means, according to National Treasury regulations, they would need to rework their budget and bring a new budget to council as quick as possible. And the DA is advocating that budget includes plans to curb electricity theft, electricity losses, as well as water losses due to water leaks.
Councillor Ace, are you able to tell me how much money had already been collected and what the status of those funds is, and whether those payments, to the best of your knowledge, might be refunded?
The court ordered that these payments will have to be refunded. What the city has actually billed is at this point very unclear, because we saw that at the time they were double billing residents. They were billing residents that were not supposed to be billed this fee. They were in some cases billing a complex and an individual account. So the billing itself was a complete different set of chaos, which the city will now have to untangle.
Who exactly is being held accountable for the failure to ensure legal compliance then?
In this case, I put the blame 100% on the politicians who ignored the community.
But which politicians in particular, though? Who carries the can for this?
The Deputy Executive Mayor and MMC of Finance, Eugene Modise.
And have you had any conversation with them about this court ruling?
We had a conversation yesterday in council. Eugene Modise left council shortly after the court ruling came out, but the ANC indicated that they are going to appeal this judgment, which in my opinion is 100% the incorrect thing to do. The city has already spent taxpayers' money to defend this in court. The residents of the city has rejected this tariff. The court has now rejected it, and it will be a massive failure from government to spend further money to appeal this decision.
And just quickly, what's your plan if the money is not refunded?
The DA is going to compile a survey which we will ask residents to fill in, that we can get information of exactly who has been charged this levy, and that we can submit that into council so that we have proof of documentation in order to track who is refunded and who not.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Councillor Jackie Ace, the DA Tshwane spokesperson for finance. And that is where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.